Thank you for tuning into this week's episode of the Rising Laterally podcast. This is Arjun Sachdev.
And this is Jay Ballou. We hope you find something here that offers you new meaning or a fresh perspective.
If you do, we encourage you to give it life.
Be bold.
Experiment.
And most importantly, bring it into the interactions with the people you surround yourself with.
And see what happens. Jay, you know what hasn't happened in a long time?
What's not happened?
The two of us just being able to have a conversation about something.
That's true.
You know, recently we've been able to feature amazing guests and authors. It's been fantastic. And every one of the books that we've talked about, we've had a natural curiosity in. But we've never actually had the chance to talk about the book between us. So it's interesting because you and I have always talked about being a portal into fascination, you know, being the connection into something that's super interesting, and then being able to take that into a real world conversation and just feel how, you know, incredible everything is. There's just the experience of living, just knowing a little bit of knowledge here and there, and how that can create a dynamic conversation or just set you apart from somebody. So it's pretty cool that in this series that we're going to do here, we're going to be portal hopping, and we're going to be able to bring people into a fascinating world.
Absolutely, man. Well, the first portal we're going to hop into will be Drink, The New Science of Alcohol and Your Health. The book was written by Dr. David Nutt. Dr. Nutt is a super cool dude. He's actually the professor of neuropsychopharmacology at Imperial College London, and he's the chair of drug science, a UK-based drugs advisory committee, and he's the former chair of the advisory on the misuse of drugs, which is a governmental advisory board in the UK. He actually gained some notoriety in the UK for being fired from that position after making the bold declaration on primetime radio that alcohol was the most harmful drug in the UK at a time where it was not considered acceptable to even refer to alcohol as a drug at all. So the book covers really the effect of alcohol on the body and the brain, how alcohol can help us open up in certain social situations, and really the trade-offs between those benefits and the obvious harms that alcohol poses to our bodies. I thought it would be an interesting place to start with this series because I have a relationship with alcohol to some extent. You have a relationship with alcohol to some extent.
Everyone we both have a relationship of alcohol. That's how our relationship got stronger.
Exactly, dude. I mean, really, everyone I know has a relationship with alcohol. Even people that don't drink, those people, in some sense, have the strongest relationship with alcohol because they've made a very concerted decision, you know, not to drink at all. So really, wherever you're at on the spectrum, I think there's relevance here. And I do want to be clear about David's position on alcohol, the author of the book's position on alcohol. He's by no means advocating for total prohibition. David is actually the proud owner of a wine bar in West London. So his mission, which is the same as our mission today, is really just trying to arm people who do choose to consume alcohol with as much information about what they're putting into their bodies as possible. I think it's really hard to make responsible choices without first being informed. You know, information, knowledge is always to our benefit. You know, here at Rising Laterally, we want to present you with facts or information you may not already be in command of, or you may not be seeing, you know, many other content creators out there put forward. So we want to put that information in front of you. And I think a good place to start would be with just a couple interesting stats that I encountered in the book that I thought, you know, many listeners might not be acquainted with. So the first one here is typically in the first world Western countries, alcohol is consumed by over 80% of all adults. Again, pretty much everyone's got a relationship with alcohol. And of that 80%, only about 1/5 get into problems with it. The other kind of companion fact to that, 30% of Americans don't drink at all, and 30% consume on average less than one drink. At the other extreme, the top 10% of Americans, of American drinkers consume an average of 74 drinks per week, which is over 10 drinks a day. That's a lot. So, you know, if you really like look at the numbers here, there are super, super heavy drinkers at one end of the distribution. But for the most part, you know, we have a lot of drinkers throughout society that seem to have like a pretty responsible relationship with alcohol, which I think is an encouraging thing.
Yeah, absolutely. This is all about knowing the science. And if you know how things work, and you can understand what type of risk you're putting yourself at. You put me on this book when you mentioned that the professor got fired for claiming that alcohol was the most dangerous drug. I mean, the fact is that he spoke the truth and he spoke up against the norm and he spoke his mind. And unfortunately for him, he was penalized. But at the same time, it's like you have to do it sometimes. Mm-hmm. You have to just, because I actually do believe that alcohol is the most dangerous drug. You know, it you mentioned it only really harmfully affects maybe up to 20% of the people who drink. But it's incredible what happens to you when you are drunk, and what mm-hmm. tricks it plays on your mind. And I know we're going to get into that, but in the context of why this conversation might be important as well, if you've been hearing about, you know, the fact that you may have to like lose your COVID-15, lose some weight that you might've put on over the last year sitting in quarantine. Well, one easy way to think about reducing calories is just reducing drinking. So again, like you're going to see me drinking again, but at least I now know the risk and the science behind it. And the best part about that is that there may be a Jeopardy question that I'm going to be able to answer because of it.
Nice. Yeah, that's definitely true. That is definitely true. Well, getting into the science, I think it would be a good place to start out with just why alcohol is such a pleasurable experience and why it is such an attractive substance to so many people. You know, it's earned a place in our culture. It's been here with us as humans for thousands of years. And there's a very real reason for that. I wanted to break down the three main effects that alcohol has on the brain as laid out by Professor Nutt. So the first one is a rising blood alcohol level increases the effects of serotonin. So serotonin is a mood enhancer. It makes you feel more empathetic. It's what leads people to see others as more attractive, the so-called beer goggles. And in that way, it has a similar effect to MDMA or ecstasy. So that's the first one, serotonin. The second one is dopamine. This increases drive, motivation, and energy. This is the factor in alcohol that works as a stimulant. It makes you feel more exhilarated, more active. It allows you to, you know, party for many hours late into the morning when otherwise you probably would have already been sleeping. The third chemical that is released in your brain after consuming alcohol is endorphins. So these are your body's natural opiates, the brain's natural pain reducing system. It's the source of runner's high. This is the reward system that gives you that chilled out, calmed down experience that you get after consuming alcohol. So when you look at all these three things together, you could see why so many people are drawn to it and why, you know, a certain number of people have problems with it as well.
Yeah. And it's unlike any other drug because it enhances serotonin and dopamine, as you said, but it also enhances another thing that I'm going to get into called GABA. And at the same time, it's blocking glutamate and non-adrenaline. So alcohol truly is a mixed cocktail. And it's interesting because when the alcohol mixture hits the brain, it starts to do things that make us like it. You know, as the author, Professor Nutt, mentioned in his book, he finds it helpful to describe the brain as working like an electromechanical machine. This machine is made up of a web of around 200 billion neurons. Mm-hmm. All our thoughts and processes are, you know, mediated by messages between these neurons. Your machine outputs, being awake, asleep, storing memories, swallowing, and so on, are the results of these millions of messages flying around the brain. Each message travels along a neuron via electricity, but the connection that bridges the gap between neurons, called synapse, is chemical. So what's important to know for the story of how alcohol works is that it works at the level of the chemical connection. And there's around 80 different types of neurotransmitters that are affected by alcohol. So the chemical messengers in your brain, there's 80 of them that get immediately affected by alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as he talks in the book, because there are so many different chemicals and receptors affected by alcohol, everyone has a slightly different reaction to it. You know, it has all these different kinds of effects that, depending on your personality or depending on your psychobiology, the way that your body digests and consumes alcohol will lead to kind of a unique experience with it. Some people get super sad when they're drinking. Some people get super hyped when they're drinking. Some people really like alcohol. Some people don't like it at all. I'm curious, just taking a step back from the science, Arjun, like when you think about alcohol and what makes it a pleasurable experience for you, like what does alcohol do for you?
I've had great times, you know, it makes me feel relaxed. It makes me feel like I have energy. Honestly, the best part about drinking is the fact that you're with friends. Mm-hmm. You're probably listening to some good music. So, I mean, overall, it just sets it up for a great time. And then you get the confidence. You feel like, you know, the world is not as heavy as it was, you know, just a few hours before that. So it's, in that sense, it's pretty cool. But at the same time, as I mentioned earlier, like I know that I've had those moments where you just don't remember anything, and those are pretty scary. And it's, mm-hmm. you know, that balance is like what makes alcohol to me and to Professor Nutt one of the most dangerous drugs in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that is a good thing to stick a flag in, even though, as I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, like most people tend to have a healthy relationship with alcohol. The, you know, 20% of people that don't have a good relationship with it, given the fact that alcohol is so widely consumed, that 20% of people makes up a massive, you know, amount of people at the population level. So even though most people have a good relationship with alcohol, it doesn't mean that alcohol doesn't wreak havoc on society by virtue of there still being millions of people who have problems with it, which leads to, you know, road accidents, suicide, you know, increases in violent crime. It can obviously devastate families if, you know, a breadwinner or, you know, mom or dad is at the helm of a family and they're having issues with alcohol. So it's definitely one of those things where it's a serious drug, and you know, when not used responsibly, it can have devastating effects both on the individual and on society as well.
Yeah, I mean, as I was reading the book, this following paragraph was something that I had to highlight. So going back to the science, going back to the balance, going back to how precious everything that's going on in our brain really is, mm-hmm. check this out. He goes, the two neurotransmitters that are the most common and the most powerful, because they are effectively the on-off switch of the brain, mm-hmm. are gamma aminobutyric acid, GABA, and glutamate. So those two, GABA and glutamate. In essence, these two neurotransmitters are the core of the brain. They do all of the basic work, such as sleeping. They do all of the basic work, such as sleeping, laying down memories, and thinking. Glutamate turns on the brain and GABA turns it off. When glutamate is released and goes across the synapse, it turns on the next neuron, which makes the brain more active. GABA does the opposite. So your brain has evolved so that every time glutamate, however you say it, is released, GABA is released too. It's this balanced system that goes on in your brain. But once you start adding alcohol, the first thing alcohol does is turn on the GABA system. So you start to feel relaxed. It's like Valium that works on the same system. The drug Valium, it works on the same system, the GABA system. So this is one reason, like I mentioned, I feel calmer or you know, I want to feel relaxed. The first thing that happens in my brain when alcohol hits it is it's turning on that GABA neurotransmitter, which is what's relaxing you. Mm-hmm. I thought that was awesome to know.
Yeah, absolutely. Super important to know. And a testament to just like how deep of a system alcohol affects. Like, as you said, those are the two neurotransmitters, like the on and off button, and yeah. Alcohol is operating at that level. So it's not like a trivial effect on your body or your brain at all. And I think in the book as well, they talk about like that relationship it has with the on and off button is why you pass out, right? Like if the
exactly
off transmitters get too far out of whack, then your consciousness shuts off. And if they get too far out of whack, then you like die.
That's exactly, you know,
So
because what happens,
definitely playing with fire.
Yeah, exactly. And so as he talks about, he says that if you turn on that GABA system too much, aka drink too much, it switches off the parts of the brain that you don't want switched off. For example, your judgment part of the brain. So here you have alcohol, it's increasing your gamma, it's turning off your judgment, and there you go. Now you know why you black out.
Yeah, I think, and remember he said one of the main reasons that people behave irresponsibly when they're consuming alcohol is because the part of the brain that tells you to stay in control, the frontal cortex, it's like the part of our brain that separates us from animals, you know, it's like executive decision making, judgment, like rational thought, that's the first part that gets switched off by alcohol. So it's no wonder people do incredibly like silly, foolish things. I'm thinking about myself here, you know, in the course of my life, when I've consumed too much alcohol, you do things that you would never do if you were sober, like, because there would be that regulating force of your frontal cortex being like, yo, that's a bad decision. But when that thing's shut off, you know, you're back into like lizard brain mode. You've lost a very important part of what makes you a rational functioning human being, you know?
Yeah, that's why the UK have a slang called legless.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah, I can think about those times where it's felt like I'm legless, and it's just the fact that the brain just can't coordinate the way it was, and alcohol is just tampering or dampening all of that. So, yeah, I mean, it's pretty interesting because there's so many tricks that occur when alcohol hits the brain.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that brings me to one of the surveys he shared about people consuming alcohol at work events. You know, like we're living in like a society now, you know, where companies, as Professor Nutt talks about, you know, have chosen to use booze as a bonding mechanism. That's not maybe like written in the bylaws of the organization, but that's just kind of the culture we're living in. You think about like happy hours, team drinks, like sealing a business deal with a bottle of wine. Of course, the classic Christmas party. And as he says as well, you know, the fallout from those Christmas parties has probably led to more dry Januaries than any other factor. I feel like we've all, not all of us, but a lot of us have acted silly, you know, in front of coworkers when we might not have, without alcohol being a factor. And that definitely leads to a lot of like banging your head on the wall the day after. But so anyway, going back to the survey, according to one U.S. survey, 1 in 3 people, 35%, preferred not to drink at work events. That's probably a pretty wise decision. 16% said they drink at them despite not wanting to, and 12% pretended to drink in order to fit in. The biggest morning after regrets of those who did drink, revealing personal secrets to colleagues, that was 14%. Complaining about work-related issues to the boss or coworkers, that's 13%. 9% said they embarrassed themselves by getting too drunk, and 8% said they engaged in sexual activity with a coworker. So again, you know, with alcohol,
not a good look.
The picture. Yeah, no.
Yeah, yeah, it happens. You know, I can think, like, I just remember there were times where I didn't really want to go out and drink, but it was like you had to. And it's just part of our culture. It's part of our society, man. It is what it is. I mean, it goes back thousands and thousands of years. I mean, like, what are we actually talking about? We're talking about people have been drinking for ever since we've known. If you go back to history, I mean, like, Romans had their affairs. Greeks had their way of drinking, mostly wine. You know, we have our bachelor and bachelorette parties, as you mentioned, you know what I mean? So it's like, apparently, what I learned about it being so far deep in culture is that in the 13th and 14th centuries, the Catholic Church was the main source of alcohol because monks held all the cultural knowledge of wine and beer making. And there's a monastery in Germany that's been producing beer that goes back nearly 1,000 years. So it's just been part of our culture. I just can't imagine it ever being removed because of all the ads that we see, and it's everywhere, right? It's so connected to sports. But I was thinking about this. I'm wondering if in a virtual reality world, you really need to drink, right? I was thinking about this because I was watching the movie Ready Player One, and it could have just been the movie. But at the same time, I was just thinking, like, there's no reference to drinks or drugs or there was maybe one where they went out to like a club scene. Sorry, spoiler alert. But I was just thinking to myself, do you think in a virtual reality world, we're going to have that much alcohol? Like if everyone has just got their pair of goggles on?
I think it's a good point. I could think the thing that I'm still trying to work out on virtual reality is like people talk about it being a total replacement for your environment. But if it's just audio visual, then, you know, you kind of lose that hugely important part of life, which is like tactile sensation. I feel like without being able to touch things and interact with the world physically, I don't think I could have see people spending like 16 hours a day in VR. But if they do figure out how to do that technology, and maybe even like, I don't know, this is like pretty far-fetched, but hack into your brainstem in a way where they can make you think you're drunk or on some kind of substance, even though you're not, I could see people escaping like permanently into those worlds if they can manage to.
Yeah. There was a reference in the book actually to a study that was done where just by the smell of alcohol, people, and the experiment was basically, you know, you were given a glass of, I guess, gin and tonic or whatever the drink was or not. And the people that were not given the real alcohol but smelled it, they were acting like giggly and flirty, and they were like, there's no way that there was no alcohol in there. So It's just, again, mind tricks and mind hacks. And I know earlier you were talking about like drinkers' regret, and that actually has a huge toll on mental health. Because again, you're just going to be beating yourself up about like the decision that you made the night before. It's just not good. And Professor Nunn actually kind of goes into that too. He talks about mental health and how if you look at like social anxiety disorders and alcoholism, there's a connection there. But the interesting thing is that we drink because we have anxiety, and then we get anxiety because we're drinking. So there's all these vicious cycles that are happening with mental health and alcohol. And I can't stop thinking about the fact that the more anxious our population is becoming, there's a clear connection to like the amount of ads that we see around alcohol and stuff like that. So it's just so much part of our culture that it's making us all anxious.
Yeah. To double click into that research that he shares in the book, he basically ties that vicious circle to increases in cortisol. So every time you wake up, you know, after a night out drinking, you're in a state of mini withdrawal. And that leads to the stress hormone cortisol being produced in your system as a way of dealing with this withdrawal. So you're slowly pushing your blood pressure up over time if you're drinking a lot and waking up every day with those spiked cortisol levels. And, you know, you always need some cortisol in your blood to keep you alive. But if it gets too high by virtue of falling into like a vicious cycle with drinking, it's bad for your blood pressure. Tissue damage occurs over time. It's much like taking steroids in the sense that it alters your ability to metabolize sugar. So it's screwing with your metabolism as well. Could potentially push you into diabetes. Granted, like those may be more outlier outcomes. But the point is, if you're in a cycle of drinking heavily at night and waking up in that state of withdrawal in the morning, you're living with baseline like higher levels of cortisol than you would otherwise if you were just like living a little bit cleaner. So it's no wonder that people get into really bad cycles with alcohol, because, you know, maybe they feel like shit, they're tired, you know, they're out of shape. And when 9 or 10 o'clock comes around at night, you know, the one thing they have to kind of escape the reality they're stuck in now is alcohol. So it's just, you know, it's a really hard thing to cycle out of if it's gotten out of control for you.
It's so powerful. It's like nobody's fault if they like go into a spiral. It's just, that's how powerful the drug is. And unfortunately, you know, society and corporations and politicians have made it seem where it's like the user's fault, like they didn't have the power or the will to overcome the fact that this drug is so powerful. So it's just like another example of how society creates the stigma for people, like, oh, you're an alcoholic, or oh, you can't handle your alcohol. It's like, I wish I could though. You know what I mean?
Yeah. For sure. And
going back to your point, it's like people, after a long day of work, or maybe the kids were just like having a day and it's just so stressful, and you just go for that bottle of wine or you have a beer or two. It's like, it's estimated that up to, or about 20% of the adult population drinks above the recommended levels. Mm. So 40 million people or more are always like putting themselves at a higher chance of having other health issues, just because it's really hard to just have like the two drinks, or, you know, mm-hmm. one drink every hour. So as you go to relax after a long day, if you go over limit every other day or every time you drink, I mean, you're leading yourself down this road that's eventually going to be where you are dependent and you become addicted.
Yeah, totally.
It's just unbelievable how addiction can start, and like you don't even know it. Like the circuits that are going on in your brain that you have no control over, really, and how they work. So like you have a reward circuit, a memory circuit, a motive circuit, and the conscious mind. And what's happening in terms of addiction is scientists can now see scans, and they see the original motivation to use a drug starts in a part of the brain that has a degree of knowledge and choice. It's not your conscious mind. It's called the drive or motive circuit. That's the part that recognizes alcohol's positive effects and then decides that you're going to take it again. So again, you're not really in control of that. But just by having alcohol hit the brain, it's hitting these circuits. And eventually that behavior is downloaded into the habit part of the brain, so it becomes hardwired. At that point, the behavior happens subconsciously without you making a decision to do it. And then that's, you know, really hard for your conscious mind to get out of the way. Like your thinking brain is not going to have control of what's going on in the subconscious mind. And so you have mm-hmm. this reward. The alcohol was really great. I had a great time. You know, I met new friends. That gets downloaded as a memory, and that becomes part of the motive. And then now you have to like deal with it in your real life. It's that cycle of addiction. You can fall into it so quickly without mm-hmm. even knowing it.
Yeah, for sure. As you brought up a second ago, I do think that there are real benefits to alcohol in social situations. Like people sometimes act as though people on alcohol are like plastering over their real personality. But in a sense, I think for a lot of people, like alcohol can let people's personality shine, in the sense that by removing social anxiety or phobias around meeting new people, it can sometimes give you actually a better chance of being your authentic self in situations where you might otherwise like clam up.
I don't know anyone in AA, but I've heard stories that people will drink to go to an AA meeting just to reduce anxiety. But I mean, even for mm-hmm. me, you know, moving into a new neighborhood, when we got a text message the other night, it was like a few Friday nights ago, got a text message from our neighbor saying, "Hey, come join us. We're having a bonfire with neighbors down the street." It's like, you know, it was a no-brainer for us to join that. And obviously, yeah. like, we took beers with us. You know what I
yeah,
mean?
Yeah, right.
Like,
yeah.
We knew that that was how you break in. And from that, it's like, wow, all of a sudden I'm having a conversation with like six other people I've never met before. We're like getting to know the neighborhood. They're getting to know us. We're asking questions. Mm-hmm. You know, we're laughing. It's like, you didn't even, nothing was awkward. Nobody's normal.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, exactly, dude. But
my point is that if it wasn't for like the drinking, it wouldn't have been the same.
I know. Totally. And as you, I think you used the word ritual earlier too. Like, you know, it is a bonding ritual now. Like being able to cheers beers with someone that you just met, or being able to, I don't know, like have a send off happy hour and have, you know, your friends buy you around. Like there's a very real significance to that ritual at this point. And, you know, I think to totally abstain from it again, maybe that's the best call for some people, but I think there is something to be said for just moderation and allowing it to play the positive role that it can play in it, you know, if you do allow for a space to have alcohol in your life.
Yeah, there's two things that I learned from the book that apply to this, because we're basically talking about how, you know, you're being social and, you know, you can organize a society at some point around that. So there's actually an anthropological theory that alcohol was a crucial element in the development of organized societies. In our species, making the switch from nomadic hunter-gatherers to farming, it says that crop cultivation may have begun in order to grow wheat to make alcohol as well as for food. So there you go. I mean, it could have been the reason why society started to organize. That's the other crazy thing. Yeah. The other thing I learned was honey was fermented into a strong, sweet drink called mead, M-E-A-D. And some people think that this may have predated the fermenting of wheat. So you had people in Africa over 40,000 years ago drinking this product called mead. And then, again, scientists have found that distillation of wine into spirits came much later in Arabia, call it around AD 900. And then the thing I didn't know for sure was that the word alcohol is derived from the Arabic al-kul, which means body eating spirit.
Yeah, not a great advertisement for alcohol. You could see the mindset of the person who came up with that word for it. And then the flip side of that, once the distillation technology reached Europe in the 13th century, you had a guy named Arnaldus de Villanova, a physician, comment on alcohol, calling it aqua vitae, the water of life. And he says this name is remarkably suitable since it is really a water of immortality. It prolongs life, clears away ill humors, revives the heart, and maintains youth. So on one side of the globe, you got people calling it the body eating spirit. The other side of the globe, you got people calling it the water of life. It's just so funny. I guess it's kind of the yin and the yang, because there definitely are, you know, there can be a dark side to alcohol, but, you know, Arnaldus de Villanova, I guess, was focusing more on the light side of it.
Yeah, because there is a light side of it.
Yeah, and the other thing I wanted to point out there too around the benefits of alcohol was the impact on creativity. So there is some evidence that alcohol actually allows people to think more creatively. The psychological theory behind this, as Dr. Nutt writes, is that alcohol stops you from focusing and cuts down your working memory. So it widens the scope of things you have in mind. And by doing this, allows you to think outside the box. So the study that backs this up was done at the University of Illinois in Chicago. The participants were given vodka and cranberry juice and then asked to do a creative word game. It was the kind where you have to think of a word that links three other words. For example, skate, cube, and pack. The link would be ice, you know, ice skate, ice cube, ice pack. And compared to those who did it sober, the drinkers were more accurate and faster. And they said their problem solving felt more intuitive too. So when you need to find weak connections between things, like when you need to quiet your mind and be able to think creatively and connect dots that may not have been connected before, alcohol can actually facilitate that because it quiets those parts of your mind that keep you in your lane and keep you from thinking outside of the box. So that is, I think, another merit of alcohol worth mentioning.
Perfect timing, because there's so much more chatter around the lack of creativity and how the world could be a better place with creativity, and the fact that in the future, you're probably going to have to create something. So yeah, great way to just tap into it. And just because, I mean, you think about it, it just goes back to what we've been talking about before. It's like you have a couple of drinks, you loosen up a little bit, and you know, you get a little freedom.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely, man. Yeah, it reminds me of, have you ever heard of the book The Doors of Perception by Aldous Huxley?
I've heard of it, have not read it.
Yeah, so he was the guy that wrote Brave New World. He had a mescaline experience, I think, in the 50s, and then put out Doors of Perception shortly thereafter, reflecting on the experience. And, you know, at the time, like, this was the pre-psychedelic era, so for him to be openly writing about a psychedelic experience was pretty ahead of his time.
For sure.
But I think the kind of key insight that he had in that book that I took away was that people are like looking for portals out of their current reality. Like when that's why I call the doors of perception, you know, when you take mescaline, those doors open up and you have a portal into a new field of perception, a new experience. And I think for a lot of people, alcohol can do that. Like if you're in a room dead sober, and then you're in the same room with the same people with alcohol in your system, that is a different room that you're in. You know what I mean? Like having a little alcohol in your system can transform the space around you and the nature of your relationship with other people. And I think that element of it acting as a portal into a new world is what makes it so attractive for a lot of people, and myself included.
Oh yeah. But I'm not, you know, I'm not a big drinker. I just feel like I've just had the experiences where I'm kind of scared of alcohol and the effect that it can have. And again, like that's just my opinion. And that's not going to stop me from having a drink with you, mm-hmm. but it just freaks me out what alcohol can do. You know, one thing I learned in this book was about strange sleep problems that are linked mm-hmm. to alcohol. This is by far one of the strangest things I've ever heard. And this is Dr. Nutt's, you know, paragraph about it. But he came across two sisters who had Sleeping Beauty syndrome, AKA Klein-Levine syndrome, KLS. So this is a rare neurological disorder where people, usually teens or young adults, fall asleep for 3 or 4 days at a time. We don't know what causes this. Scientists think that it comes from some form of inflammation, maybe a virus that's damaging the wakefulness promoting centers of the brain. They think that there's certainly a genetic component as well. And the craziest part about it is that the same thing happened to each of the sisters, but 3 years apart. So the very first time these two sisters had alcohol, which was not at the same time, they fell into a deep sleep for days.
That's an interesting one. That is a super interesting one.
Yeah. Again, this goes to show, well, it could have happened with any drug. I'm not trying to pinpoint alcohol here. I'm just saying that like, that's what made this book so cool to read. Just because again, these are things that I never knew before. And honestly, like as people are going to come out and, you know, getting vaccinated, they're going to go hang out. They're probably going to be having drinks with people. How much can you really talk about what you did during quarantine? Like this could just be that one thing that you share with somebody and it could change the relationship that you have with that person. So I don't know. The way I look at these types of conversations is I love the books that we read. I want to talk to you about them. And at the same time, like, want to be able to share, like you can just bring this up in a conversation with somebody and see what happens. Just again, food for thought for anyone listening to this. You ever wonder why it's loud at places like bars? Well, science might explain that, you know, if a place is really loud, it's hard to talk to other people. And so you really have no other choice but to like go grab that other drink. So I'm just saying, there's all these little mind games that go on in society that get you to drink more. And if you know about it, it's kind of funny and amazing to observe.
Totally. Totally. The other one was that most sporting arenas have banned bottled beer because they're afraid of people breaking those bottles and turning on each other with them because the relationship between, you know, alcohol and violent behavior. But it's crazy, man. Now, every time I walk into an arena, when I see everyone holding plastic cups or cans of beer, I'm going to think about the fact that the event organizers have very deliberately chosen not to have bottled beer available, you know?
Yeah. At the same time, that's why they stopped serving after the 7th inning in baseball as well, because they don't want you to have drinks in the 8th and 9th because you probably had enough by that time.
Yeah, right, right.
But no, in terms of other tricks or psychological games, you know, that I learned from the book, there was a study from the School of Experimental Psychology from the University of Bristol that showed that people drank lager 60% more slowly out of straight glasses than out of outward curving Pilsner style ones.
Wow.
The theory there being that you drink a curved glass faster because it makes you think the halfway point is lower than it really is.
Wow.
Wow. And here I thought that it was airing it out.
I know, right? That's another mind game, dude. Same thing with just beer having a higher alcohol content overall than it did 10 or 15 years ago. Like, you know, the craft beer thing has really taken off. IPAs have really taken off. Yeah, a lot of people find them to be tastier than your average light beer, but they're also much, much higher in alcohol content. So like, you know, a couple buddies maybe going out to the bar in the 60s and 70s, drinking an ale, a lager, an ale at the pub that was maybe like 3 to 4%. That's a totally different thing than now. People going out to the pub or the bar to have a couple of IPAs that are like 6 to 7%. You know, it's like almost twice as much alcohol that you're consuming with the same volume of beer. So that's another thing that, another way that things have changed, and without really paying attention to the significance of the change, you lose the fact there.
Yeah. And here, you know, it's, so we're drinking higher percentage alcohol. Many people have been drinking more. And so there's this subsensitivity to alcohol that may be taking place. The reason I'm bringing that up is because apparently you can pass that trait down to your kids because of the altered GABA system. So GABA that we were talking about earlier. So this whole idea of like how alcoholism can actually run in families. If your parent has had or is currently an alcoholic, your risk is 3 to 4 times higher yourself. So it's interesting that we're, you know, as this society continues to drink, and they do it in front of their kids, and then kids, you know, starting at 15 years old, you know, half of them are already drinking anyway. It's like we're just passing this trait to the next generation.
Yeah, totally. And I think there was information there as well around how people that don't get hangovers have a higher likelihood of becoming dependent on alcohol because there's not that deterrent. You know, if you can have like 2 bottles of wine a night and wake up and feel chipper, you know, that definitely puts you, I think, at greater risk than someone who has to deal with the pain of a hangover. So another thing to consider, you know, if you are a heavy drinker or a drinker and you don't experience hangovers, you might be missing out on a deterrent that could be useful. So it's just something, again, just another thing to be aware of, you know?
Absolutely. And that's actually a great segue into a super interesting drug that I learned about in this book. Apparently, you know, doctors don't really prescribe medications for alcoholics. But there is this one that was super interesting. it was discovered in Italy. And this professor, he bred a strain of rat called the Sardinian alcohol preferring rat. Then he looked for drugs that would stop them from preferring alcohol. And he showed that sodium oxybate stopped rats from drinking as well as prevented them from having withdrawal symptoms. Then he demonstrated that the same thing happens in humans. So in Italy, they've had this sodium oxybate for over 20 years. They've had it in Austria for over 20 years. It's being reviewed by the European Medical Agency right now, but apparently it's like also super deadly on the one end. So like the fear is that if you give it to everybody, like there may be abuse, but he's been able to show that this sodium oxybate makes you not want to drink. And then also prevents, any withdrawal symptoms. And the fact that you had mentioned earlier that, you know, some people don't have that, but most people do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Again, the book is Drink, The New Science of Alcohol and Your Health. It was written by Dr. David Nutt. We hope you pick it up. We hope you spread the word on this episode. And maybe at some point, we'll all know a little bit more about alcohol and the effect it has on our bodies and our brains.
Max benefit of alcohol with the least amount of health risks.
Absolutely. That's the name of the game.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can sign up for the Rising Weekly newsletter sent out each week.
Every Friday, we expand on the episode with insights, recommendations, and more.
You can sign up at risinglaterally.com.
Thank you.